Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Richard Jennings, who is a designer of sustainable water systems, and talking about some of the interesting metaphors and realities of water systems that we have here in New Mexico. Right now, I would like to welcome Eliza Naranjo-Morse, she and Luchasar Boyajia, and they are both with Site Santa Fe. They're part of the biennial, which is called Lucky Number 7, and they will be speaking tomorrow, July 8th, in a talk at 6 o'clock at Site Santa Fe called Talk as Talk Can, a conversation with not only Luchasar and Eliza, but Nora Naranjo-Morse and Rose B. Simpson, who all participated in this project that we're going to be talking about. Their piece is called Storyline. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Eliza, let's talk about your piece first. You and your mother and cousin, Eliza and Nora and Rose B. Simpson, have made something which is very organic and looks like, I don't know, a plant or mythical creature of some kind snaking itself not only around Site Santa Fe, but all over the city of Santa Fe.
Right.
Tell us about the origin of the project.
Well, the idea originated equally, I think, from the three of us. We sat down together for coffee at the end of the week that we spent with all of the 23 other artists in the biennial, and I don't even know that it was much conversation, but we knew exactly how we were going to present this idea, and it seemed clear to us that we would use clay. We're all clay artists. And the concept of a single line emerging from the ground and traveling through the city seemed to also just sort of appear for all of us.
What does the line represent, or what multiple things does it represent for you?
The line is a representation of how every person emerges from a place, from their mother, and it's a representation of traveling through the world, as every person does. At one point, the line in sort of the main room of Site Santa Fe fragments. It starts to break down, the clay starts to peel off of its structure and spill out onto the floor, and that's a representation in everyone's life at that point when they're breaking down, fragmenting, going through some point in their life that's difficult. The line after that moment recollects itself and then continues on.
And so you have it not only in Site Santa Fe, but in a couple of other locations. And one of them is at the Museum of the Institute of American Indian Arts. And it's fantastic over there,
Thank
what
you.
You've done. It looks like, I don't know, like a sci-fi set or something.
That's an interesting interpretation of it. I think that it's unusual. Hopefully it's sort of subtle. I imagine that most people pass down that, that street and don't notice it at first. The color is sort of subtle. It's not meant to be very grand. It's meant to look quite natural, and it's meant to just sort of drape over the side of the building in this hopefully graceful way. Quite simple, hopefully.
So what was the nature of the collaboration among the three of you? You're all from Santa Clara?
We're all from Santa Clara Pueblo. We're all family. We're all artists. I, of course, grew up in my mom's studio. And I grew up playing with Rosie, and so this was sort of an adult version of playing with Rosie and hanging out with my mom in the studio. We had to think of the concept, and after that it sort of was about doing what came naturally to us, and that's applying clay to the wattle, applying clay to the structure of the pantyhose.
And those are the materials underneath that support this
right.
snake-like thing. I mean, I don't know. Do you think of it more as a plant matter or a living animal creature?
I don't think that any of us think of it as either. It's a representation for any person's life and the traveling in that life. And for us, the material is of course very dear. The clay is very dear. So it's sort of its own entity. It's clay, a clay line.
What tell us how this arises. I mean, you grew up in your mother's studio, and I love the idea. This is an extension of playing with Rose. But how does it relate to some of the clay traditions in Santa Clara?
I think that the root of it is very similar. It's from the same root. We're clay people. We're building our homes out of clay. There's clay is a huge part of our ceremony and our dress in the ceremony. It's a material that the three of us use. And, you know, I'm sorry, I forgot the question.
Just how it relates to Santa Clara.
Oh, and how it relates to Santa Clara. So this is a material that we're all very familiar with. The way we collected the material was similar. We went to the same places that we collect the clay for our own work, for our own homes, our own ovens, processed it in the same way by sifting it. The difference is that we're not firing the clay, but in every other aspect, I think even in the sense of respect we're offering to the clay, it's the very same process that we're using.
So the biennial goes on for a period of months, and then what happens? Do you take this down, or does it return to nature by itself? Obviously inside the building you'll take it down, but I was thinking about the pieces outside.
Right. Well, everything has to be taken down eventually. There's the structure inside, the wattle and the pantyhose, and that would look sort of unattractive to be draped over the IAIA, a bunch of, you know, disintegrating hay. And so I don't know exactly what we're going to do with the material. We can't give it to somebody. Nobody else is going to want this material. Maybe we can cut it up and take it to our homes, or maybe, I guess what we'll probably do is disassemble it and put it back into the ground.
How have people responded to it so far?
You know, people have responded all kinds of ways to it. It's been really exciting. The most exciting part was fabricating the piece or the pieces, and the moments when I found that people were really relating to the work. We had, at one point on Garcia Street, we're working at the School for Advanced Research, and there was a young family that had come to see what we were doing. A lot of people were curious about it. And the father asked me what the project was about, and I explained the project as a representation for someone traveling through their life. And while I was explaining the idea of fragmentation and then picking yourself back up, picking the clay pieces back up and having it continue, he said, "I know exactly what you mean." And for me, that was very, very satisfying to know that we could build something that is pretty abstract, that's pretty conceptual, but it's hopefully a theme and creates an emotion that many people understand. Everyone can relate to being born and traveling and having those moments of breaking down and building themselves back up. So I don't know, but I hope the reaction has been good and people haven't told me otherwise.
I passed by today the School for Advanced Research to see the piece that was there. It's really on, you don't even have to go into the school to see one of the pieces. It's right on in the trees in front of the School for Advanced Research on Garcia Street. And I thought, I wonder how many people are going to know that this is a sculpture versus some natural element.
Right. I think in that case specifically, it's kind of beautiful because it does look incredibly organic and not with human touch to it. It looks sort of like some sort of vine draping and sort of dancing along the trees. And I think that's the intention for each of the off-sites in the St. Francis Auditorium. Of course, it doesn't look as organic because it's attached to a wall. But even then, it looks sort of vine-like. I think our intention and our intention with the use of the material and in terms of it, the way we put it together aesthetically, is that it looks like it could just be something growing out of the ground.
And then I wondered, if people don't realize it's art, has it succeeded as art?
Oh, gosh. What do you think about that, Luchasar?
I think yes.
No. Yeah.
It's not necessary for art to startle people or to stalk people. Whoever notices and thinks of it as art, that's enough. And if somebody does not notice the piece, and it means the piece is very natural to its surroundings, it achieves its purpose in another way. So, I mean, we cannot expect that everybody is born to art, you know. Some people need further education, enlightenment, you know, instruction. Some people need to ask questions and have answers. For other people, it just happens naturally. Everybody is predisposed to appreciate art, but not everybody, unfortunately, not everybody has the time or, you know, has the eye. Just like I cannot repair cars, for instance, you know, or I cannot do, rodeo. You know, maybe a rodeo rider cannot do art, but you know, that's why people interact with each other.
Right. Yeah. I don't think that the intention by my mom, Rose, or myself is that the work is very noticeable. That's not really the point for us. But if it is noticed, I guess all the better.
And so the locations are in Site Santa Fe and in the School for Advanced Research. There's two pieces there. Then the St. Francis Auditorium inside of the New Mexico Museum, right on the corner of the northwest corner of the plaza. And then
on top of the IAIA, the Institute of American Indian Arts downtown.
Museum downtown right near the Cathedral of Santa Fe.
Exactly.
And so those are the places where people, if they're passing through Santa Fe or if they live here, can see this work.
Right.
Now, let's turn to Luchasar Boyajiev. And you are doing another very interesting piece, all of which one part of it is on site, is in Site Santa Fe.
That's right.
And then the rest of it is off. Describe the one that's in Site Santa Fe.
Okay. Well, it's all part of a one and the same project. And the one that is at site, it's the so-called Bill Wall. But it's just the beginning of a loop that is supposed to go out of Site Santa Fe and then possibly transfer people back into the main venue of the exhibition. So this Bill Wall is just it's the nearest to the initial idea I had while in Santa Fe in January this year during the preview visit that all the artists took together. It was initially I wanted to distribute all of my production budget to people in Santa Fe, like $7,500 in $100 bills, but then the curator needed me to do some other things for the biennial, so I ended up having 77 $10 bills on the wall, and so under each bill there is a name of a person that I picked up from the Santa Fe telephone book, and if you happen to see your name under the bill, you're allowed to take the $10 bill with you. Which it's kind of it's funny because the admission is $10, so you actually get to see the show for free. You don't gain much except under the bill there is a useful message. It's like a fortune cookie message. The messages range from the just good luck to something which is pseudo Jenny Holzer, to some like trivial messages, to some messages that I picked up overhearing other people talking, or there is a lot of. I asked Rose Simpson, for instance, to write some words for me because she's also a poet, and they're also credited to her, but I don't think that any such message is revealed yet.
Right.
And there are some messages which for me are extremely important politically, although not in a direct way, which have to do a lot with the multi-layered culture and history of Santa Fe, I hope. So this Bill Wall at site, it's a way to get in a very concrete contact and very real contact with concrete people in Santa Fe. Whether it will work, I don't know. But
I went. Some of the bills are gone, and people have picked them up. But it was not the majority so far.
Well, the show's gonna go on for 6 months.
Yeah.
So hopefully, at this rate, by the end of November, we'll have all the messages revealed.
Right.
Which for me, it's important. But this is it's also like a work in progress. Although it's a very simple mechanism, which I've used for this particular work. In other exhibitions elsewhere, I've also distributed part of my production budget, but there is always a different mechanism for that. Money is like a universal equalizer. You know, it's like Marxist. I was trained as a Marxist as
right,
a young child.
In Bulgaria.
You know, I grew up in a socialist country.
Right.
So Marxism is my second name. Right, and then the names of the people. They're picked up at random, supposedly, but as I believe there is nothing really random in this world, at first I started playing with looking for the nearest equivalent to the artist names in the artists in the show. And so there are some names which refer literally to artists' family names like Mangan or Beltran, or Naranjo, or Simpson, for that matter.
Right.
That's easy. But my own name, the nearest equivalent is like Boyd, something like Boyd, or you know, that's not really easy. I found a funk person up in Los Alamos. I found, of course, you cannot avoid. I couldn't help not including a name like Oppenheimer, but I'm not gonna give you the first name because that person needs to go there and find out by herself.
Oh, so you're not calling people or writing to them and letting them know. They have to figure it out by word of mouth.
Word of mouth. I mean, I prefer that. Of course, after a while, I mean, it's, you know, I can, if I run out of money right now for the next week, I can always go and you know, take some $10 bills. It's my work, so I can probably do that. But the other, there are names there like Love, Luck, the name of my first dealer, or no, the current dealer, or first collector, or girlfriend, or curator, or this and that. So it's always, it has some personal secret meaning. Sometimes it's more obvious, sometimes it's not. So it's not just money. I mean, money is always, there's something personal for some people, especially in this country.
Now this, I mean, the work that you do is very much about getting conversations going. How do you, where does the conversation happen in this one?
Well, it happens in front of it, if it happens at all, but it's just part of the conversation. The whole conversation starts there, at site, but then it goes on to these other six locations where I have the so-called hotspots.
Hotspots.
Which are nothing else but kind of gator board panels, and I have started putting... I started writing texts or making drawings there, making comments on the other works in the show, or the whole show, or whatever happens in... before the opening of the show, or making references to where I come from, and so on. And then there is a lot of text, photographs, drawings. The six locations are, one is probably the most important for me in terms of my own who I am and where I come from. That's in IAIA, which is the same room we share with the end of Nora, Eliza, and Rose's work. It's a very key location. It's
okay.
Just before the toilet, so and the projection room, everybody goes there. So it's really important, this room. Then I have in Palace of the Governors, Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. I have hotspots in the Museum of Indian Art and Culture, in the Spanish Colonial Art Museum, and the Center for Contemporary Art. Each one of these hotspots is dedicated to a specific angle. Like in Spanish colonial art, it refers to Martí Anson's work, this small scale model of a factory that is nearby, and also to the sort of the gift economy, because every time you go to a place for a biennial, if you're an artist, there is this aspect. I mean, do you contribute? I mean, this question for me is a very important question. Do I contribute anything to the place where I go to, or do I only take? Is it only about career, or is it also about this conversation and interaction and playing, actually? I mean, Eliza and Rose started playing, and for me now it's the time of playing, with the other artists in the show and people in Santa Fe. And that's why I'm staying on after the opening. In the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, it's about women, maybe. It's about the machism of Los Alamos and the weapons there, and the feminine appeal that Santa Fe has for me, personally. It's always like kind of convoluted, like female psyche, and it has these shapes that are very appealing to me.
Did you say convoluted like the female psyche?
Yeah. That's what I said.
I'm just going to let that go by for now.
I can afford to say such a thing. I know that it's not really politically correct. I'm aware of that. But as far as I come from the Lower East Side of Europe, which is a place that does not even register on the American identity screen, I come from a country which is so small, you don't even notice it on the map. I can afford not to be politically correct. Because, I mean,
politically correctness is one thing, it's just accuracy is the other. Truth.
Okay.
Truth and so on.
All right, maybe it's only the... Yeah, okay, fine. I take the criticism. I admit that maybe... this is... should we go back to the works and
yes.
the biennial, or should we go to the election campaign in America, which is like the main things for me while I'm here?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, in this election campaign, everybody every once in a while says something and they have to go back on their words. I just said something about the psyche and I have to go back on this and sort of try to correct it. But it has something to do with the works because it's always... You were mentioning this, the work of Nora, Eliza, and Rose, and it is like a storyline. I even think that the title of this work outside is storyline, isn't it?
That's right.
Okay. So I've tried to structure my own works also as storylines, also as somehow that in my works here, in these hotspots, there are a lot of arrows, a lot of connecting lines of different character, a lot of forms that sort of try to establish connections. And at the end, if you go to all these six locations, if you try to read the messages, and if you are allowed to input, it's the platform for feedback, so it's another situation of dialogue, you end up being in a kind of a very convoluted story about the exhibition, about some of the artists, or this particular artist who has structured the whole thing. And going back to your initial question, this loop I was referring to, in the middle there is a group of people, the so-called art squad.
That's
the really convoluted part of my project. That is, I hope it will evolve with time. I see these people as double agents, as spies who are spying between the city and the biennial, and they're collecting information about as far as like feedback goes. And some of this information they started collecting during the gala, the opening days, and that's extremely interesting because it was basically wealthy people who are supporting the biennial, but at the same time I'm not so sure that they are really interested in talking to the artists or getting to the bottom of the artworks. Maybe they are, but
maybe some of them are.
Most of them are, you know, judging, especially people that I've met so far. But another thing, as a foreigner, I just have to share with you that this is like an amazing biennial. It is actually a very small one. There are less than 20 artists. I mean, there are more artists, but there is, like in the case of Nora, Eliza and Rose, it's one author in this exhibition. Normally, and this is in the last 15 years, this is my maybe 35th or between 35 and 40 biennials that I've done in the last 15 years. So it's like I can tell you that this is a small one. At the same time, the size of the length of the preview days, 4.5, 5, it's like it's the scale of Venice Biennial, which is the largest in the world ever, or Documenta, and these are the top events of contemporary art. Documenta is in Kassel in Germany, Venice Biennial in Venice, obviously, in Italy, and Documenta happens every 5 years, so it's a rarity, yeah? But yet the preview days are the same in terms of length as in Santa Fe, which means that the so-called community of Santa Fe, which I take a community in the case of Santa Fe, it's really a huge generalization. There are so many different layers in this community, and there are so many different aspects of interaction that I cannot ever hope to be aware of, let alone analyze. But it's a credit to the community that there is so much attention given to the opening of the biennial. I hope that this continues during the whole run of the show. For 6 months. I mean, there are quite a lot of visitors every day, so that's a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, of course, things like this always have a lot of energy at the beginning, but a work like yours is one that continues throughout, and one, you know, I'm wondering, like, I went up and saw some of the hot spots, and it was mostly your handwriting so far, and again, it's early in the process.
Well, you have, you know, I was the other day, there is enough, I'm happy. For the time, like, for a period of time, like 1 week after the opening, I think there is more than enough. And I'm photographing some of these messages. Well, the big question is, what happens at the end with these? How do we? I mean, we keep a photo documentation of the whole process. But what happens? I would love to see these boards at the end, and I would love to analyze them, to find out whether there is something meaningful in terms of dialogue.
Because that's a question that I have for you. Yeah. Is how do you generate, I mean, you're interested in generating dialogue among and between people of different demographic groups, different cultures, and so on. How do you do that? How deep can it go? You know, how do you organize a context for that to happen?
It's just a question of time. And obviously, I started doing such projects only because there was one question about 8 years ago in my mind. Usually artists are gone after the opening, and I never get to see who goes to these shows.
Right.
So I started looking for ways, and I think I have found one of the possible ways to stay over after the opening and then meet the actual audience. And it's, as I said, it's just a question of time and place. If there is more time, I can start a dialogue about the biennial here, but I have to perform, and that's a different context. I need to have my gadgets, I need to have maybe a t-shirt to separate me and to indicate to the people that this person is doing something that is not threatening, but potentially it might be for you, it might be interesting and useful. And you know, this is like a traveling circus. It could be.
You talked before about coming from Bulgaria, and Bulgaria is not on the radar screen of many Americans, which is probably true. Although it's a country that I became aware of when the Bulgarian Women's Chorus was so famous and was touring the United States, and everybody loved it, and I loved it. But what is the context, the artistic context and the conversational context that you and your work are coming from Bulgaria?
Look, I wish that people who come tomorrow for our panel discussion would go to see the IAIA room and this board of mine there. I come from a country which where folkloric culture survived until well into the 20th century, because it had been for several centuries under Ottoman domination, so it didn't have its own political sort of superstructure or elite and so on. I come from a country, for instance, my family on my father's side comes from a small village in the right in the center of the Balkan Mountains, which is the center of the Balkan Peninsula, and my two generations back, my ancestors were pottery makers. The workshop is still there. They in a way they also worked with clay.
Right.
The house where my father was born is made out of clay and wood. So there is this. I mean, this is like these are people, and my ancestors. They lived in a situation very much in relation to the land, which I can relate in a way to the Santa Clara situation.
Right.
Although of course it's a completely different part of the world, completely different political history, and so on and so forth. But I can tell you that in some ways the artistic tradition where I come from, it doesn't actually exist. It's very spotty. In the 20th century, there were waves of modernism and provincialism and really a big struggle for the artists to combine the modern language of art with their background. And so this same situation I went through in the early 90s after the Berlin Wall, when the whole world opened for me and my friends and colleagues in Sofia, and we had to find a way to relate to. I mean, if you want to stay where you are, it's fine, you can just be there, but if you want to relate to other people around the world, you have to sacrifice some things. You have to find out what they are interested in, not only what you are interested in. And that translates immediately into subject matter, into material, into format. I was accused in the 90s, not only me, but others as well, but simply by picking up a video camera or using the language of installation, you're kind of betraying your artistic cultural tradition. And the answer I could give is, I mean, usually that would be painters talking to me like that. I would say, I mean, you're talking as if oil paint was invented in Bulgaria.
Right.
That's not the case. I mean, it's quite complicated. But it's at the end, it's that's why we're, I guess, if you're an artist, and that's why I'm here. If I had been not successful in asking and finding some answers, at least which are meaningful for other people, I wouldn't be here in the first place.
Well. Much more to talk about on this subject, and the two of you, along Luchasar Boyajiev and Eliza Naranjo-Morse, as well as Nora Naranjo-Morse and Rose B. Simpson, will be speaking at 6 o'clock tomorrow night, July 8th, at Site Santa Fe. The conversation among the four people, talk as talk can. Are you going to also be conversing with the audience?
You know, I think that we're meeting at the end very soon to discuss exactly how this is going to go, but I imagine that it'll be just a conversation between the four of us and then perhaps some questions.
I hope there will be questions.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us, and we will see you tomorrow night.
Thank you.
Yeah, see you. Thank you.
We'll take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Richard Jennings. He is a designer of sustainable water systems. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's
great to see you again.
It's good to see you. It's great to have you here. Now, you have been working on not only sustainable water systems, but what you call biomimetic metaphors for water and nutrient recycling. That means that you take man-made systems, like water systems, that people invented, and base them on human and animal, digestive processes?
On nature, basically, on natural processes and systems.
So how does that work? How did you start thinking about it that way?
Actually, this got started for some years ago, whenever Helen and Newton Harrison were here at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and I worked with them on their exhibit. And one of the
it was a good 3 years ago, I think.
Yeah. One of the things that we talked about in many, many conversations was analog systems, analog forests, analog lagoons, analog soils, things where you take a system and build it to be an analog of the real thing, but it's completely man-made.
And so what are some examples of that?
Well, what I'm doing is also relating to biomimicry, the work of Janine Benyus and her writings. The idea is to take human-created systems and try to make them function like a natural system, to be eventually self-organizing and self-maintaining, as opposed to needing constant inputs of money, energy, water, et cetera, et cetera. So
that's a tall order for things that are made of, you know, pipes and screws and stuff like that.
Well, one of our principles is that everything has to, a good system is biologically complex and mechanically simple. So the less pipes and screws, the better in the long run. We use them, but we use them judiciously, you could say, so that everything we do has a reason, and it's the hopefully the cheapest and simplest and most robust way of doing things. The first kind of metaphor that I came up with was everyone uses the toilet and then the material goes away, but where is away and why do we want it to go away? Basically, there's a book called Future Fertility by John Beebe, and one of his premises is that what goes out one end came in the other end, and it's essentially the same stuff with slightly different characteristics.
So, well, hang on a second. What you eat is full of nutrients, and what you get rid of
is full of nutrients.
Oh, I thought you'd absorb most of the nutrients.
No, you absorb some of them, but then what do you do? If you absorb them and it never comes back out, you'd explode, right? I mean, you burn the starches and sugars as a metabolic processes. The protein makes your body, and then it breaks down and it goes back in your urine. Your feces contains a lot of the undigested stuff. And in that is the mineral content of what you ate. So what that means is that what goes in one end comes out the other end and has the same nutrients pretty much that can sustain you if you transform them back into something you want to eat.
And so that is obviously, on the face of it, E. coli heavy, stinky process. You know, what is the cycle like from, you know, essentially what goes into the toilet to something useful for humans?
Okay, well, first thing we did is we looked at the digestive process, and you have the small intestine, the large intestine, and then we looked at the septic tank as the square intestine, the third stage of digestion. And in that process, you can pretty much eat all the things that you don't want, or the bugs, the bacteria will eat it, and transform it into a clear liquid, which is metabolized partly by what we call the lungs of our system, which is a small aquarium-sized air pump that uses 25 watts of electricity. So now we're respirating and we're metabolizing and digesting in the square intestine.
So the square intestine is filled with a particular type of insect or creature?
Well, I say bugs are actually microorganisms.
Okay.
They're mostly lactobacillus species that were collected by the inventor of the system from underneath redwoods. And the reason that that's important is because they've lived in and evolved in nature and are able to eat a lot of things, including breaking down cellulose in toilet paper, things like that. They're pretty hungry and robust bugs.
And so what goes into the square intestine is from your toilet. What comes out is what?
That's what we call blood. Blood for the earth, right? It's got oxygen and it's got nutrients and it's a clear liquid. It doesn't have the iron, so it's not red. But in essence, it's blood for the earth. And with a pump tank that distributes it, we then are re-nourishing the earth with the same nutrients that came from the earth to nourish us.
And in that, you can then grow food or flowers or anything?
Food, fiber, fuel, beauty is important, habitat, shade, windbreak, all the things that we really need in semi-arid areas.
I think there has been so much hesitation or really... you know, resistance to using human waste in useful ways because of E. coli, because of bacteria, and not to mention the things like antibiotics and prescription drugs and all the things that that our sewer systems are dealing with. How is that dealt with in your system?
Well, one way is I don't eat that stuff. So that's a personal choice that, you know, you can eat organic food and you can eat and not dose yourself with a lot of chemicals. And if you don't use them, you don't have to get rid of them. So on one level, that's one way to do it. On the other level, there's what's called retention time in the soil. Most things are food for some organism if they have enough time to get at them and eat them. So E. coli is a food when it gets in the soil.
Yeah, that if you eat the most organic diet in the world, the E. coli is still there.
Well, yeah, there's always bacteria, viruses, all kinds of things. But they'll either be absorbed or eaten in a healthy biological system.
And so how do you, as master of the sustainable water system, make sure that all these processes are working properly, that you have enough microorganisms, that these processes are continuing as they should?
Well, you can lift the tank, the lid of the septic tank, and take a whiff. If it smells good, it's working. It's that simple. And if the plants are growing, it's working. It's really, natural systems are pretty much self-organizing if you get them set up right, and they take care of themselves.
And so you don't have to keep on adding lactobacilli and stuff like that?
For the way our company does it, we check the system twice a year and make sure that it, you know, like a pump didn't die or something. Other than that, no, there's really nothing to do except flush your toilet and watch your plants grow.
Now, does this rely on what people call a composting toilet? No, that's a different thing.
No, this is a different thing. That the composting toilet doesn't use any liquid.
Right.
And this is based on the idea that pretty much everyone in this society wants a flush toilet. So why not turn it into a system to distribute moisture and nutrients instead of a polluter?
Now, is this legal in the city of Santa Fe or the county?
Yeah. I had probably a history of being a little too experimental in my early days, but now everything we do is permitted. So they're all legal, they're all permitted, they're all inspected. So yes, you can do it anywhere.
We're talking to Richard Jennings, designer of sustainable water systems. How much actual land minimum does a household need to have a system like this that functions?
I've got a 900-foot square orchard, and that's pretty much enough. It's partly how intensely you want to distribute and store your nutrients and your moisture. The other metaphor that I use is the analog riparian area.
Right.
And this is based on the fact that in semi-arid areas, if you look around, you will find that most of our rivers and streams, our perennial flows, are really now in our sewers. They're not in the stream banks. They're in pipes underground.
That's a pretty amazing concept.
You know how I got that? I took a class of sixth graders out on a field trip to the Santa Fe River. And one of the things I do is we have scavenger hunts, which is kind of a way for them to learn about what's in the river, which was not water. It was like shopping carts and trash and things like that. And they'll have like a bingo card and they fill it out with what they found on their scavenger hunt. And one of the things they pointed out to me was, hey, there's no water. Would you bring it? See, this isn't a river. And this was right upstream from the sewage treatment plant. And that's where our perennial flow is. It comes out the back of the sewage plant. There's always river running south of Rodeo Airport Road.
Through the sewage treatment plant.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, on the face of it, kind of a depressing thing. When you use that as a metaphor and you think of sewage as an analog to a river, how do you use that in a positive way?
Well, you have moisture and nutrients. So if obviously, you know, the fishing and swimming and things are out, but what you are able to do is establish analog riparian areas, which is the stream bank, the moist area along a river where biology is concentrated, where resources are concentrated. Because of the moisture and the nutrients, you have more plant life, You have an overstory, you have shade, you have a much denser habitation by birds, insects, small animals. You have a corridor for wildlife. You have a place for pollinators and beneficial insects. So I'm just dealing with what we got. You know, it's not as obviously as pleasant as a flowing river, but it's also distributed more widely throughout the community and can be used as a resource.
If a lot of people did this, would things like aquifer recharge happen in a more efficient way?
Depends on where you do it. A lot of this area does not recharge the aquifer. It's mostly along the mountain front and in arroyos and stream beds. So, yeah, there could be some. One of the things that we did with the Harrisons that I came up with was called Seeps and Springs, and it was a concept to treat our sewage on the way down to the plant with smaller package plants on the assumption that a lot of the sewers were failing. And in the course of replacing the pipes, why not put in small plants? Treat the sewage and then release it like seeps and springs into the river after it's been cleaned up. And as it turns out, I just read a book that I got a couple days ago, and they're doing that in Barcelona, Spain.
Really?
They have wetlands all up and down this river that act as treatment and polishing, and then they have the amenities of a running river with clean water.
So the wetlands actually work as a sewage processing plant on some level?
If they're designed, there's treatment wetlands and then there's natural wetlands. This is a one that's engineered to do this, and there's pre-treatment to take out the chunks before it gets there. So what you have is an effluent that the plants can finish off and take up the nutrients.
We're talking to Richard Jennings. Now, can this be implemented, for example, if you know, Santa Fe or some other community had the will to try to do things like this using natural analogs for their sewage on a mass scale? Is this something that could be, well, you talk about Barcelona, it can be implemented on a mass scale.
Yeah, Barcelona is a whole lot bigger than Santa Fe.
Yeah. When you bring this up, I mean, do you talk to people about it in public life? What do they say?
Well, one place that we talk about, and I'll get a little plug in here on the Radio Cafe, is for the Semi-Arid Cafe, which is a informal group of professionals that meets once a month and discusses these things. That's where a lot of these discussions go on. Some of this came out of my head, but a lot of it came from collaborative discussions and trying to break each other's designs and looking for, you know, weaknesses in everybody's thought process.
Trying to break each other's designs, that's how all good science works, I suppose.
Well, yeah, as long as you don't have ego involved, so that what you're looking for is the best answers. And it started out, me and another associate, Reese Baker, came up with this about a year ago. And we call it Beertopia to start, but that wasn't a real good name for a professional group, so, and it had the wrong focus. So now it's a semi-arid cafe. And if I could give an email.
Sure.
It's Dana, D-A-N-A-G, Simmons, S-I-M-M-O-N-S, @gmail.com.
DanaGSimmons@gmail.com.
Yes, and if you send him an email and say, put me on this semi-arid cafe list, he's like our webmeister savior, because neither Reese nor I can do this kind of stuff on a coherent basis, and Dana takes care of it for us. And there's engineers, there's lawyers, there's inventors, there's landscapers, there's architects.
Now, we talked about it. It's not really about recharging the aquifers, but is there a water conservation angle to it?
Yeah, sure. Think of El Dorado. So they use, depending on whose numbers you look at, anywhere from 25 to 50% of their water is used for watering, for landscape irrigation.
So basically,
that's a diversion, right? You're taking that out of your drinking water stocks and putting on plants.
Right.
If you don't have to do that, you've eliminated the diversion, and there's where your water conservation comes from. You're using everything twice. You're using things that would normally be pollutants. You can look at the energy balance of diverting, cleaning, pumping, distributing the water, so you're conserving energy as well. Because anytime you use water, you use energy. Anytime you use energy, you use water.
So in a place like El Dorado or any neighborhood in Santa Fe, if a group of neighbors got together and wanted to do this, in theory, they could save a lot of money by doing it together.
That's our next step, is cluster systems, is to womp it up from what we know works on the individual level to large scale. And when you increase scale, you get economies of scale, which means it costs less per household or per person, and you get the benefits of the same type of system. So if you have 8 houses on a system, you'll have a slightly bigger treatment system, but nothing that big. You'll have 1 pump instead of 8 pumps. You'll have 1 brain instead of 8 brains. We have designer own controls, which are our biomimetic brains, basically. They make simple decisions about what they should do. So you'd have 1 brain, 1 pump, which is the heart, 1 set of lungs, et cetera, supporting 8 people or 8 households. And the whole idea is to make this as inexpensive and widely used as possible.
And in theory, for institutions like schools, it could work very well, where there's a whole lot of liquid going out, a whole lot of waste going out, but then there's also things like playing fields and open land around it.
Yeah, we got one at Monte del Sol that we
and it's up and running.
It's up and running. Their garden to school program has been running on rainwater it's a combination rainwater and sewage treatment system with automatic transfers of liquids and stuff like that.
So this could really have a significant water saving and energy saving effect in a place like a desert place like Santa Fe.
Oh yeah, and the other thing about Monte del Sol is they have a weather station and they have a lot of readouts, so they can do student-type science there. So it's a way for them to learn how to design, think, build, operate, and see things, you know, see their orchard grow, things like that.
Richard Jennings is a designer of sustainable water systems here in Santa Fe. If people want to reach you, how can they do so?
Probably www.earthrights.com.
Earthrights.com. Richard, thanks so much.
With a W.
Earthrights with a W. W-R-I-G-H-T-S. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for your good work and service to the community.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.